Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the tech net as we've done for 34 and a half years. Main purpose of the tech net, as you guys have heard so often, is education. We amateurs come together Sunday night, the curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless technology and related things, gather and teach each other how radio equipment really works, because the schools and the books only do a mediocre job of teaching that. Particularly when it comes to antenna design, the schools do a particularly poor job of not, in other words, not giving students in engineering schools clear, working, useful knowledge about how to design antennas. You want an antenna designer, you most likely have to hire a ham radio operator. There are 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now is 2-meter FM repeater. And before you give up this extremely educational hobby, if you're disappointed with it, then try one of the other 26 or 25 kinds. Let me drop them. Tonight, on the science and physics section, run by Roy AC2GS, quite possibly he's going to give us another chapter. I think there's going to be multiple chapters on what really is going on with general relativity and special relativity. And we're all going to have to hear it quite a few times because it's pretty complicated stuff. And the first time you hear it, it doesn't all make sense. We're probably also going to hear about tonight the astronomical event that will be happening Wednesday evening. A full eclipse of the moon combined with other astronomical events taking place at the same time. We'll also be hearing from Paul WS2N with Space Report number 284. You're listening right now to Technical Net number 1684, which began in September of 1982, 34 and a half years ago. Let me drop it. This particular net might be a record holder for the total number of years on the hours on the air, which I think is well over 6,000 hours, more hours than Johnny Carson in his 30 years of running The Tonight Show. And it may also be a record for the total number of years of operation of a net under essentially the original leadership. In the beginning, I thought the technical net we'd be answering people's questions for a couple of weeks and we'd dry up and go away. Here we are 34 and a half years later, and we've realized now that there's an extremely large thirst for knowledge about radio equipment, because amateurs talking to each other with all of their little, rules of thumb and so on, the little snippets of information they all gather when they compare it with each other, you end up with a very large body of knowledge of how wireless equipment really works. Let me drop. So, as a sign-in, we don't make those two mistakes everybody else makes. Everybody else will say, is there any emergency traffic right now? There never is, but they always ask that question. And they also, most nets have everybody signing in. Long list of people. Start off with only the K's and only the W's, only the N's and so on. We don't do any of that jazz. After 34 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed. And Eric KE2EJ, the guy who's the technical maven of this equipment, has a couple of years ago hooked up Echo Link and IRLP, so we get sign-ins from not only the tri-state area, which this repeater covers, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, the metro area of them, but we also occasionally get sign-ins and welcome them from people in other states and other countries. My job. So, you're only going to sign in if you've got a question or a comment for the net. We don't need a long list of names of people that are listening. After 34 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. That's already been proven to us. Not everything you hear on the technical net is 100% accurate. No engineer, no matter how hard he tries, is ever 100% accurate. We've all got a battering average. None of us bat 1,000. So occasionally we make errors. But by way of the peer review process, we eventually find out about our errors and correct them. Essentially, every one of these tech nets for the last 10 or 11 years are recorded, and you can play them back by going to the website www.amateurradio.tangovictor. At amateurradio.tangovictor, you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you'll see four individual one-hour reels of the with everything, all the sound that took place for that particular night. So by way of people listening to that, errors are discovered, and we correct them. So there's no guarantees, but the price is right. Another website you'd like to know about is limogtechnet.com. That's run by Mike number two. Mike number one was, I keep forgetting the call letters. I forgot my little note here. Okay, Mike number one, Mike number two. Mike number two at amateur radio at limogtechnet.com has other pieces of information relevant to the TechNet. Equations, pictures, graphs, and so on. Let me drop. Okay, so at this time, we're going to take check-ins. You're going to, if you do have a question or a comment for the net, you're going to first give me your call letters and your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Try to remember to leave a gap between each transmission so you can hear all four beeps. If you fail to do that, you might get timed out. They might not hear what you're going to say. Okay, so give me your check-ins right now for people who do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening. My name is Dick.
WB2QEQ. One yes question.
WA2RYY, Joe, yes. WA2VBZ, Frank, yes.
Okay, I heard Joe, QEQ, and Frank in that order. WB2QEQ, I should know. Please tell me your name, sir.
Len.
Okay, so we got Joe, Len, and Frank. Anyone else to check and give me your call letters and name right now?
WA2RYY, Joe, yes.
We've got you signed in three times now, Joe, WA2RYY. Joe, we've heard you. We've heard you, Joe. We got Joe, Lynn, and Frank. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilo Delta 2, Oscar, Victor, Mike. Axel, in Brooklyn, New York.
Kilo Delta 2, Oscar, Victor, Mike. And what is your name, sir?
AXEL.
Very fine. Axel.
2TTT, no.
Now, there's a guy who runs a TechNet also in New Jersey, W2TTT. And that's why he's got a no. But he's listening. He's checking on the accuracy of what we're sending tonight. So, Joe, we're your number.
Tango, Gordon, no.
That's the second time you signed in, Gordon. We've heard you both times.
Leah 2, TTT, Gordon, no.
Okay, maybe the link to the 975-375 is not working. Gordon, W2, TTT. We've heard you sign in three times. Gordon, we've heard you sign in three times. W2TTT. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2IBP, New York. Lake Grove, right.
Okay, you're going to have to give that to me phonetically. Kilo Delta 2, it sounded like India Delta Papa. And did you say your name was Ray?
QSL on Ray, Kilo Delta 2, India Bravo Papa.
Very fine, Ray. India Bravo Papa. Because your particular rig is giving us no audio beyond 1 kilohertz, I can't tell the difference between Delta and Bravo. They sound the same. Okay, let's see if Joe is hearing us now. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Joe, go right ahead with your question. K2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, first of all, I thought the 60 cycles always come from you, but it's not because your audio is clean. My question is actually pretty simple. It's concerning antennas and which 25 of the subjects. Consider this, and it's probably a knowledge question for me, but for knowing what we do with something like this. If you have a dipole, say, for example, on 40 meters, and it's 33 feet each way, which is about what it would be for 40 meters, and it's fed with a ballon, that's very simplistic. Now imagine on each leg of that connection point to the ballon, you connected another wire at the same length, but went out 90 degrees. So in other words, say your two wires going east-west, and your right-hand wire, you put another wire on that going north, and the opposite end of the ballon, the other side of the ballon, you put another wire going south on that leg. What would that do? Two questions. What would that do to the impedance? And would that cause any adverse effect? Because it's sort of simulating almost a horizontally polarized antenna that's omnidirectional. Over to you.
Hey, you got a pretty good question there, Joe. Assuming your dipole is in essentially free space or high enough up, a half-wave dipole on 40 meters, roughly 67 feet long, made out of, let's say, 14-gauge wire, will have a center impedance very close to 72, 73 ohms. And as long as you've got it electrically the right length, it'll have no reactance. Make it a little bit too long, it'll be inductive. Make it a little too short, it'll be capacitive. But and you can easily, with your antenna analyzer or your standing wave ratio meter, you can easily find out is it too long or too short by sweeping it in frequency and looking at the bathtub curve of standing wave ratio versus frequency, and the dip in the middle is where it's resonant. So you find out real fast. Let me drop. A second dipole at right angles to the first dipole. The first dipole is east-west. The second dipole is north-south. They are orthogonal to each other. They do not couple if they were fed independently. Each has its own independent pattern. When you connect them together in the way you're describing, first of all, two things that are uncoupled from each other in parallel will take the 73 ohms down to 37 ohms. You're going to see an impedance in the center of roughly 37 ohms. But now the north and east leg is going to be one side of your ballon. The south and west leg is going to be connected together, your other side of your ballon. Therefore, radio-wise, the radio signal is going to think that the north and east half of the dipole is just a very fat dipole. Therefore, pattern-wise, it's going to be as if you had a 45-degree dipole. It's going to be a dipole. If you laid out a dipole where one wire went to the northeast and one wire went to the southwest, that's close to the pattern you would get. You're going to get a slightly more complicated pattern. Pattern-wise, there I'm not completely sure. Impedance-wise, I'm a lot more sure. And would it be a thoroughly omnidirectional antenna? I think the answer is not. I think you're still going to be getting, with that combination, you're going to be getting a null to the northwest and a null to the southeast, is my belief. Here, I'm not absolutely positive, and some further experimenting would be required. Let me drop. And the only way to really run that experiment, to be running it at a VHF or a UHF frequency in an anechoic chamber. The nice thing about antennas is they scale. You go up in frequency, which means you're going down in wavelength, and if you change every dimension of the antenna, all the diameters and all the lengths, you change it by the ratio of the old length and the new length, you get the exact same pattern, the exact same impedance. Antennas, almost all antennas, will scale as a function of wavelength. So in an anechoic chamber, you could prove the pattern that I'm speculating about. For you to really prove that pattern by setting it up in your backyard, where in reality you get ground reflection, you get reflections off the house, you get reflections off the gutters and downspouts of the house, the wiring in the in the neighborhood, to really confirm what the pattern is like and where the nulls are would be kind of difficult. I didn't say impossible, kind of difficult. But these are my speculations as to pattern. And as I said before, I'm much more in confidence as to what you would see in impedance. And with that ballon that perfectly gave you a good match before, and now you've got these two dipoles in parallel with each other, so to speak, you're going to get roughly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which means half a dB of loss from the ideal world, which ain't bad. to B2LYY. That's my speculation so far, Joe. I'll be thinking more about this over the week. K2IW, the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, at what point does the impedance start changing? I mean, say if you have, like, you know, two wires on each leg of the dipole, that's the same length. It would just make the conductors actually thicker and give you a little lower Q, yielding a little better bandwidth. So as you move these two conductors away from each other, at 90 degrees, it's going to give you half your impedance. If you moved it further back the other way, would it be start being maybe less of that much of an impedance drop on a particular frequency of choice? And do you think your pattern would start approaching more of a horizontal type of pattern without too much cancellation?
You essentially have a north-south dipole and an east-west dipole connected together. If we talk about the right-hand side of the balance, where half a dipole goes to the east and half of the dipole goes to the north, and those two pieces are at 90 degrees apart, and the same thing for the other half, there you're going to be getting the 37 ohms I predicted. As you start taking that 90-degree angle between those two pieces of wire and making it 80, 70, 60, start moving them together. When you go all the way where the piece of wire that was previously going to the north is now parallel to the wire going to the east, and you do the same thing on the other side. When they're completely parallel, instead of 14-gauge wire, you've got the 12-gauge wire, so to speak, which is very little difference in impedance. You'd be back to 73 ohms. So 73 ohms when the wires are together. As you start spreading them in a slow, continuous manner, you will go down to 37 ohms. So at 90 degrees, you got 37 ohms. At 0 degrees, you got 73 ohms total, and a slow glide between the two. Each half of this balance-fed structure really acts like a fat dipole, so to speak. So the pattern you're going to get when they're spread at 90 degrees is if you had, my speculation is you're going to have a pattern as if it was a 45-degree dipole, northeast and southwest. And as you move them closer together, it always radiates broadside, just that you've got a fat dipole to the right and a fat dipole to the left, skeleton fat dipole, that are still going to be giving you pretty much the same pattern with a predictable location for the null. That's my speculation on that one, Joe. So you can continuously change the angle between those wires if you want to, say, for instance, have a complicated way of hitting 63 degrees.
Repeater, timeout.
Having a complicated way of hitting 63 ohms, if that's what you wanted. W2LYY, K2LAW.
Well, I wasn't worrying W2LYY. I wasn't worrying so much about the impedance change, because you could change the length, obviously, to get the thing tuned on your specific frequency by, you know, or do alter the length, you're going to bring the impedance back up again. If it's 34 to 40, 37 ohms, I guess if you shorten it, it'll start going back up again a little bit to give you, if you wanted to get a 50-ohm match on that, on a 50-ohm transmission line through the balance. But my curiosity was more of the thing resembling, say, like a, what they used to call it, an FM turnstile antenna, which is horizontally polarized, but pretty much omnidirectional. You got one leg going, you know, east-west, another leg going north-south, even though that's a folded type of dipole. That's what I'm more interested in, if it seems to give you more of an omnidirectional, horizontally polarized type of structure, more than anything, more than the impedance matching.
Once you're hanging that wire in the air, you've got a horizontal dipole east-west and a vertical, another horizontal dipole north-south. If you fed it with a quadrature balun, if you fed the east-west and the north-south, you fed them 90 degrees apart. That would be a pure turnstile antenna. That's the closest you're going to get to omnidirectional. Now, the FM antenna that claims to be omnidirectional has got a funny, snaky shape to it. In other words, the wire on each side is a sort of a semicircle, and that gives you closer to an omni pattern, but still it's got some wow to it. It's not a purely omnidirectional pattern. You get much closer to an omnidirectional pattern with the turnstile approach, feed the two dipoles 90 degrees out of phase. When it comes to length versus impedance, you said some words, and if we took your words literally, you said it backwards. Let me drop. When you go to either of those websites, particularly the one by Mike number two, which is limarktechnet.com, there you'll find the article by K2RIW about impedance matching a T-match antenna. But it really is impedance matching any dipole. The thing that's the world's best kept secret is that you can get any impedance, resistive impedance of your dipole, anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms. Your dipole will be a resistive component as low as 1 ohm, as high as 1,000 ohms, if you do nothing but change the length of the dipole. That's the good news. Choose the right length. Look at those Brown and Woodward curves that are in that article. You choose the right length and you'll get any impedance you want. That's the good news. The bad news is that anything less than or more than a resonant length is going to give you some reactance. If, for instance, you make it too short, it's going to be capacitive, and along with the number of ohms you want, there'll be some capacitance left. If you put a shunt inductor across the center of the dipole to correct the reactance, you make it go away. Or if you make it too long, the impedance will be higher, which means it's now inductive, and you're going to add a capacitor across the center. And when you add the right capacitor, the reactance goes away. So by doing nothing but adjusting, let me drop. By reading that article, by doing nothing but adjusting the length of the dipole, and then, in the general case, put the right reactor across the center of the dipole, and there's some interaction here, but and the article explains that, but you can make the impedance of your dipole a perfect impedance, any impedance you want. If I want the resistive component to be 31.5 ohms and perfectly resonant, that article will tell you what length to choose and what size of capacitor to put across the dipole to get exactly that effect. The articles you read up till now have you build all kinds of complicated triple wires and folded dipoles, fancy T-matches and gamma matches, all kinds of physical structures to get some other impedance for a dipole. You didn't have to do that. If you understood what the Brown and Woodward curves are telling you, that best-kept secret that nobody writes about, I tried having that article published by QST and Ham Radio Magazine, and they said, hey, this is an article about dipoles. Everybody knows about that, and they turned it down. Therefore, you have to go to that website to read the article. But the article tells you this well-kept secret of how to get any impedance you want and resonance simultaneously with nothing but length and a single capacitor or inductor hung across the center of the dipole. So, once again, to repeat, make the dipole longer, it'll become inductive. Make it shorter than resonance, it'll be a capacitor. And the resistance changes continuously as you change the length. Shorter and shorter, you go down to 1 ohm. Longer and longer, you go up to 1,000 ohms of the resistor component, if that's what you want. As I said, you're now hearing a secret piece of information that has not been published in the general magazines. The V2RYY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, very good. You gave me a lot to think about. I don't know if I have the room in the property to construct something like that to be able to get more of an omnidirectional type of horizontally polarized array, but it's something to think about in the future, at least, if I want to do something on some of the higher frequency bands. Okay, thanks for the info. Back to you.
Yeah, to repeat once again, Joe, to really guarantee omnidirectional pattern, go for the turnstile. These fancy shapes is a poor man's equivalent of a quasi-omnidirectional pattern. It's still got some peaks and valleys to that pattern. If we find the right article on that so-called FM antenna with a snaky shape to it, I'd love to see the pattern of that thing. Guarantee it's not purely omnidirectional. It's close enough to omni. I mean, if the peak and valley happens to be 3 dB apart, and you're using an FM receiver, and you're close enough to the broadcast station, the 3 dB is not going to hurt you, if you know what I mean. But you're a purist, and you'd like to have a purely omnidirectional pattern. We can only guarantee that with a turnstile approach, in my opinion. Next person on the list was Len, WB2, Quebec, Echo, Quebec. You got it, Len, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah,
thank you. Good evening. Len here. Just a quick question. I picked up some aluminum tubing at a garage sale, and I have suspicion that it was some sort of a vertical antenna. I have no idea what kind or what it was. Taking some of it apart, I found inside one of the lengths of tubing folded up yellow jacketed coax cable, quite a length of it when I spread it out. I don't know what it is. It looks like about the size of RG8 or something like that. I was just curious if you knew if the yellow jacket had any significance to the coax. Over to you.
Yeah, there's a company on Long Island, I can't think of the name of them right now, that makes coaxial cable. Something Wire. Something Wire is the name of the company. Yellow Wire or something like that. There's nothing magic about the outer covering being black, yellow, red, whatever. And the length of coaxial cable is some kind of impedance matching device. This aluminum tubing, you didn't tell us, but I'm guessing there's a one or two insulators somewhere. It's not one continuous piece of aluminum tubing. Somewhere there's an insulator, and various portions of the antenna are fed with a folded up length of coax cable acting as a delay line. So it sounds to me like it's either a multi-band antenna, probably HF, multi-band HF antenna. Maybe it covers, 40, 15, and 10, so to speak, meters. And to give us some more information about the approximate length of the coax, the approximate length of the pieces of tubing, and the approximate locations of the insulators, various people listening to us can say, oh yeah, I recognize that. That's a blank brand name of antenna, and that's their model number 45. So if you give us some more of the details, there's probably people listening that'd be able to guess what it was, Len. And were the ground plane radios also on this thing? WB2QEQ. K2LIW. Yes, Len.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that information. I try to come short lengths of this cable for jumpers inside the shack, which doesn't seem to have any ill effect, so maybe I'll just play around with it. I got it cheap enough, so I just thought maybe it has the color has some significance. But no matter. Go on to some a little more interesting questions, and I'll be standing by listening. Thank you again. WB2QEQ.
Yeah, one of the guests here, Len, is that under normal circumstances, the outer covering on the coax is fairly thin. It's only there to give us weather resistance, if you know what I mean. It's not weatherproofing. If you had solid polyethylene for the dielectric of the coax cable, then yes, you get weatherproofing. But if it's foam-filled coax, braided outer conductor, and then some kind of a plastic-like covering, that is not a hermetic seal. It's a weather seal, but it will slowly leak water vapor into the foam, and so many of these foam-filled coaxes will slowly increase in loss. Now, the Insulated Wire Company, I think is the name of the company, that makes coax cable with an outer jacket that's yellow, and for all we know, the yellow outer jacket is thicker than normal because this coax acting as a balloning device inside of the aluminum tubing is under some certain conditions going to develop a fairly high voltage between the outer shield and the aluminum tubing that's containing it. Therefore, you've got a strong E field across that aluminum, that yellow sheathing. Let me drop this.
W2TGT info.
And so you got to worry about that thickness to whether or not you get a breakdown. Gordon, do you recognize that antenna? W2, Tango, Tango, Tango. What a nice set of call letters. K2IW. Over there, way over there in New Jersey. You got it, Gordon.
I apologize. I got a case of the stupids when I was checking in and was listening on the feed, not on the radio, and I realized I was out of sync by about a minute, so I apologize. In the meantime, if it's got a center insulator in that vertical, then it's probably a butternut vertical. I seem to recall those things. I seem to have one or pieces of one as well. So I think it's a butternut vertical.
The particular butternut vertical that you think it is...
Repeater, timeout.
As you can tell, I didn't wait for the beep. Stand by. The particular button on your vertical that you think it is, Gordon, make us a guess. Is it a 40, 15, and 20? What frequency regions? So if Len goes to the Butternut website, he may find an antenna that looks like what he's got, and he'll be able to recognize it. Your best guess is this. What bands do you think that particular Butternut vertical covers? You've got it, Gordon. K2RIW.
By default, it's 40, but it might be 80 if it's got the big coil at the bottom. I believe so. I think it's good for at least 6 meters, if not 2 meters. It's something ridiculous like that, but not a bad antenna. Very popular. But its big deal is it's a dipole, and therefore you don't have to have radials.
You made the same mistake I did, Gordon. You didn't wait for the 4 beeps. Lucky for you, you didn't time out. Thank you for the information. So you've given Len some more information as to what to look for. Next guy on our list was Frank. I think it's WA2, Victor Bravo Charlie. You've got it, Frank. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, Whiskey Alpha 2, Victor Bravo Zulu Frank. My question for you, Dick, is right now I live in Queens and I have a ranch house, so I have my antennas outside, obviously, up on the roof. I may have to move to a garden apartment complex soon. My question is, I know it's like HF antennas inside are next to impossible, but would I be able to use a variable magnetic loop indoors to get some decent receptions over to you?
I've got a whole lot of good news for you, Frank, which is a lot different than all of the old wives' tales you've been hearing for years. And Victor Bravo Zulu, again, Z and C. Zulu and Charlie sound the same, so without you going phonetic, people are going to be making that mistake. I did. Every antenna you and I have ever built can be squeezed down in size with no loss in performance. That's the world's best kept secret. I'm going to give you an example. I'm using an 80-meter dipole in my backyard at some reasonable altitude, maybe 50 feet, strung between trees. 80-meter dipole, full length, 132 feet long. My property is not big enough. So I squeeze the 80-meter dipole, not 132 feet, I squeeze it down to 32 feet. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves that are in mic number one or mic number two is the website, you'll be able to predict exactly what impedance you're going to get. I'm going to make a rough guess. A 80-meter dipole squeezed from 132 feet down to 32 feet, your 70-ohm impedance is probably going to go down to 18 ohms of resistive component, and the reactive component, the capacitor reactance, is probably going to be 1,000 ohms. It's going to be a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna, if you don't do something to it. Now, if you use the compact antenna concept, in other words, you now know the impedance, the resistive component, you do something to correct for that, maybe the right kind of a balance. You get rid of the reactive component by putting a loading coil somewhere. It's either an inductor across the center of the dipole or a loading coil at the bottom or top hat capacitors. You do something to re-resonate it. The best-kept secret, but it's well-published way back in 1950 by the father of all good antennas. All of a sudden, I can't think of his name. The guy from Ohio University. My goodness. He wrote the book Antennas. My mind's going blank on the guy's name. Anyhow, the book Antennas, 1950, McGraw-Hill, by Krauss. There we go. John Krauss, WHJK. He said that every dipole, an infinitesimal dipole, gives you the exact same performance as a full-size dipole. No loss in gain, no loss in pattern, a huge change in impedance, but once you correct for the impedance and re-resonate...
Repeater, timeout.
Once you re-resonate it, you get full performance. Whenever you squeeze down a dipole, and you've made it out of low-loss materials, you haven't made it out of skinny little pieces of wire, you'll never lose more than half a dB of gain, and the half a dB of gain you've lost is not a change in efficiency. The pattern becomes a little bit fatter. The bad news of making a small antenna is it becomes very high in Q. That's a fancy way of saying very narrow in bandwidth. A full-length dipole covers half of the 80-meter band. You squeeze it down, it's going to give you high vis well when you tune, when you QSY more than 50 KC or 30 KC. So every time you change the frequency, you're going to have to re-resonate the antenna. Using an antenna tuner, you're going to have to readjust your antenna tuner. So it's very narrow band. But at the frequency in the center of that bandwidth that it's got, you'll get full performance. So every antenna you've ever used was in with reason. And this is not quite true of Yagis, but the simple antennas, dipole and quad-like antennas, you can shrink them down any amount you want, put them in your apartment. Now, whether or not the radio signal can get into your apartment, because maybe you've got wire lashing in the walls, maybe your apartment's in the basement of the building. Let me drop it. As long as the signal is really there when you're receiving, you'll get full effective capture. Here's the other thing that's way out of common sense. You ask any electrical engineer, any good, experienced ham radio operators, what happens to the effective capture area when on that 80-meter dipole I went from 132 feet down to 32 feet? They all will tell you the effective capture area got smaller. You're going to pick up less signal. Absolutely not true. That's what Krauss is saying in this very respected book called Antennas, and it's, and it comes in three different versions, by the way. He's got edition number 1, 2, and 3, but the original edition tells you the infinitesimal dipole gives you full performance. So you buy the right antennas, you build the right antennas, whether they be magnetic loops, maybe with multiple turns to get the resonance back as opposed to using loading coils, or making them dipoles that have got zigzags in them and helical winding, top hat capacitor. There's all kinds of ways you can make a small antenna that fits inside your apartment and gives you full performance for the signal that gets to that point in your apartment. Let me drop. You're going to be fighting a whole lot of people that tell you you're crazy and it doesn't work. I can give you lists of people who have done it and it works like a charm once you get past all of the old wives' tales, if you know what I mean. Common sense doesn't work that way. The antenna rebuilds up that effective capture area in the effect of it having high Q. High Q means the signal bounces back and forth a hell of a lot more times on the small antenna. That's why it's got so narrow a bandwidth, but in all of those bounces, it picks up all of that effective capture area again on both transmit and receive. So in your apartment, you've got to be a little bit careful now. If you're running a 1,500-watt output transmitter and you're going to put it 5 feet away from your head, I don't recommend that. Make sure the antenna itself in your apartment is, let me pick a number, 10 feet away from you, if you know what I mean, when you're putting 1,500 watts into it. But all the antennas you want can be squeezed into that apartment or on the roof of that building if they'll let you do it. And so it's just a matter of going, doing, and experimenting, and don't listen to all the people who tell you it can't be done. Over to you, Lynn. And by the way, when you do this, please come back and tell us your successes and your failures, and we'd like to hear more about it. WB2QEQ, K2RIW. You got it, Len. Wait a minute. I think it's Frank. I got the wrong guy. Whiskey Alpha 2, Victor Bravo Zulu. You got it, Frank.
K2RIW, WA2VBZ. Yeah, I know. My call sign is definitely a tongue twister. You definitely opened up my mind, and I'm going to Google this antennas by John Krauss. And also, I'm going to Google compact antenna concept, because I think, you know, from what you're talking about over here, you know, that will definitely give me a little bit better idea of what I'm dealing with. I don't like to run any kind of power. In fact, I'm somewhat of a queue up here. But you've definitely given me a lot to think about, and it's kind of like, you know, I was thinking, geez, once I move, you know, I'm losing all hope as far as ever getting on HF again. So I truly appreciate it, and I want to say 73 and thank you.
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of warning. John Krauss wrote an extremely pivotal book by the McGraw-Hill Book Company, and he published it in 1950. It's called Antennas. It's a book, not an article. And it's a fairly technical book. It's intended for graduate-level electrical engineering, RF electrical engineering, taught at Ohio University. That's why he wrote the book. And the section on dipole antennas and the so-called infinitesimal dipole, That chapter is there, and it will give you that information I just gave you. But it's not in nice, simple ham radio vocabulary. This is a technical book for a graduate-level course. And so if you go to the right website, you probably today can download the Hold On book. Or maybe you can even download that section on dipoles and proper impedance matching and so on. So it's an extremely good book, not necessarily easy to read. The average amateur reading that book is only able to absorb one-third of what it's trying to say because of its rather technical method of approach, lots of equations, lots of derivations of the equations. It's not at all like the antenna book by ARRL, which is a hell of a lot more easy to read with a lot more graphs and good useful information, if you know what I mean, in useful engineering format. Let me drop it. So the data I'm telling you about is there. I didn't say it's going to be easy to read and easy to understand from that particular source. Take my word for it. If you have any doubt, come back to me next week if you want and ask us more questions. But any simple antenna you want, I'm not talking about a five-element Yagi now, but antennas with one driven element, so to speak. There's a zillion ways you can make a compact antenna with full performance, a nearly 100% efficiency that will fit into that apartment of yours. So go to it, Tiger, and let us know what you find out, Frank, as you do it. The next person on our list was Axel, Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Victor Mike, if I can read my own writing there, Axel. Over to you, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening. Yes, my question is a basic one. It's about RF grounding the equipment. Let's say it's easy for a person that has his shack on the level ground floor to put a rod and connect everything to the main connection. But let's say somebody that lives on a second floor or in a building, and that person, if he does such a thing, will produce what is called like an antenna, let's say. Instead of rejecting RF, he will induce more. What kind of solution or solutions there are available for a person that has a situation like that? Back to you.
Now, when I turned it over to you, Axel, you did not wait for the four beeps. You could have timed out the machine. You were lucky you didn't. You just came right up to the edge of not timing it out. Now, RF grounding of antennas. Oh, boy, is that a subject good one. A lot of emotional response from a lot of people. There's three reasons why you ground, maybe two. I think there's three reasons why you ground an antenna. The first and major reason is human safety, lightning protection. You'd like to have some kind of grounding associated with your antenna, but if it's struck with lightning, there's a good way that the 11,000 amperes can get conducted to ground as opposed to coming roaring down your cable and going into the front end of your transceiver and doing damage. And even if that does happen, it's not the end of the world. With rare exception, lightning striking your radio equipment will blow out the first transistor in the receiver, which is a replaceable item. Rarely do you get that kind of damage where the receiver becomes a loss. Let me drop. So grounding for lightning safety. Grounding for human safety as far as the 110-volt line is concerned. Long Island Lighting Company or Con Edison, the way the wiring of your house works, whether it's the 110 line or the 220 line, you'd like to have proper grounding of the chassis, again, for human safety reasons. If the chassis of your radio should have some kind of a failure of its wiring inside so that the hot lead touches the chassis and the chassis is 110 volts above ground and you touch it and touch a water pipe, bad things can happen. That's the second reason you do grounding. The third reason everyone believes you want RF grounding is to get better performance from the radio antenna. That's the most mysterious one. That one, 90% of the time, is not true. Let me drop. There are a whole lot of people who believe that if your antenna is not properly RF grounded, you will not get full RF performance. With rare exception, that is not true, even though everyone believes it. Yes, there are simple kinds of antennas where, say for instance, you build a vertical ground plane antenna, and you decide not to put on the ground plane radials, the counterpoise radials, and you want to use local grounding rod instead, if you've got a big enough grounding rod and you're close enough to the earth, that can work. In that case, you do need grounding. But for any antenna that is quasi-symmetrical RFY, it's like a full half-wave dipole, a folded dipole, a loop antenna, things that have complete closed circle RF performance within the antenna require no grounding, and if you supply the grounding, it makes no change in the performance. There are also people who believe that when you better ground the antenna, the standing wave ratio behaves better, and you get less television interference. People believe that. With rare exception, it's not true. So the majority of antennas that you buy that are made for performance where it doesn't have to lay directly against the ground, against the earth, as long as you've bought an antenna that's not designed to lay directly against earth, you can get full performance on it on the 15th floor of a building with no local RF grounding. You're going to create good grounding for human safety reasons, but RF grounding most of the time is not required, even though a lot of people think so. You have a little bit of a need for local grounding. Let me drop. If it's a random length end fire piece of wire, if you throw a piece of wire out the window for a long distance to a tree, to another building, so to speak, and you're feeding one end of it, the way you ground your equipment in that case completes the circuit, so to speak. But if you're really feeding an antenna with coaxial cable, and the shield of the coax cable goes to one part of the antenna, and the semiconductor goes to the other part, now the antenna, in most of those cases, requires no RF grounding. So you're worrying about RF grounding at, let me say, the 15th floor of a building. In most cases, Axel, is not a real requirement as far as radio performance is concerned. Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Victor Mike, K2RIW, wait for the beeps. You've got it, Axel. Kilo Delta 2. Oscar Victor Mike, you still there, Axel? K2RIW.
Hello? Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Victor Mike. I was listening the transmission from the internet. That comes a little delayed.
I understand. So, with the internet, you've got the delay. We'll wait for your delay. And did some of that material make some sense to you, Axel? Back to you, K2RIW.
This question comes because I have tried performance with two different radios, but one has a lot of filters built in it, and the other doesn't have that. But still with the other one that comes incorporated with lots of filters, you can still hear some RF, but it doesn't bother that much. The main thing is probably some kind of maybe power lines. Also, changing a type of antennas also made a difference. When I tried a vertical, I got a lot of... looking into a solution, trying to see the possibility to try to eliminate that if there was something like that and it was real or not. And like you described here, it's more like a myth than something else. It sounds like.
KD0IKL with a question for the net.
Stand by, KD0. Axel, Your audio is very low. Your audio is very low, and we're getting a 60% dropout on your internet connection. So we're only hearing pieces of your conversation, I'm sorry to say. I can tell that you're checking on two different radios, and one of them is giving you a whole lot of extra noise, if I understand correctly. So you may have a local interference problem, assuming the radio is working correctly. So that's a separate set of issues. But changing the grounding quite often will not change whether or not you're picking up local noise. It's very difficult to hold a conversation right now because your audio is so low and 60% of the signals you're giving to us on the internet are dropping out. So we're only getting pieces of the conversation. We're going to be going over to Ray next, but before we do, I think we got another person signing in. Kilo Delta Zero India something. Give us your full call letters and name, and do you want to go on the list of people with questions? You'll be number two if that's true. Kilo Delta Zero India blank blank K2RIW. My name is Dick. Bravo Zulu with a comment.
NY9A, yes.
N19A. That doesn't sound like real call letters. N19A. And Bravo Zulu. Bravo Zulu, go ahead with your suggestion.
My name is Rich, Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. Just two things. John Krause is from Ohio State University, not Ohio University, where I graduated from. And I was just wondering, how that MFJ makes an artificial ground. And I used to live in an apartment building in the city, 30 floors up. Now I live, in a condo right on the ground level. And I was just wondering if that at all fit in with what you were saying about the ground.
Yeah, very fine, Rich. Yes, there are companies building an artificial grounding device. And it's just another resonator between what you call the grounding or the shielding, so to speak, of your rig or the antenna and Earth. It's another resonator which takes the length of wire that normally would go from, let's say, the 13th floor of a building down to Earth and resonates it so that it gives you a low impedance as opposed to the normal reactance. If you're using a kind of an antenna that requires local grounding, like an end-fed ZEP, then yes, you'll get some increased performance out of using that. If you're using a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a dipole, where when you're feeding a dipole, you're at half of the cycle, you're pumping current into the right side and taking current out of the left side of the dipole. And the next half cycle, you're doing the opposite. It's a thoroughly balanced antenna. An astronaut in his spacesuit, 100 yards away from the International Space Station, in free space, with a dipole in his hand. He's now 200 miles above Mother Earth. Let me drop. He obviously has no hope of any local grounding. What in the world would the word ground mean to that astronaut floating with his spacesuit 100 yards away from the International Space Station? He's using his backpack booster, if you know what I mean. And he's firing up this dipole. Will the dipole work? Absolutely. Give you 100% performance. So most balanced antennas require no local grounding to give you full RF performance. But now if he's feeding a great big long random length of wire as an end-fed ZEP, so to speak, the capacitance of his body to the rest of the universe is the other half of the circuit. And so local grounding there, without local grounding, if he was operating the end-fed ZEP from his backyard and his house is at ground level, and he's got a local ground, that end-fed ZEP will look to him like it's got, let me pick a number, 150 ohms of resistive impedance, and maybe a certain amount of reactance that his antenna tuner takes care of. You now take that exact same antenna, and you give it to that astronaut. He doesn't see the impedance as 130 ohms anymore. He sees the resistive impedance as some very high number, and the capacitor reactance as some big high number, because his body and the capacitance between it and the rest of the universe is the other half of the circuit. It doesn't mean it's not going to work. It just means he's got a much higher impedance to feed. If he's got a wide enough range on his antenna tuner, he can still make the end-fed depth work with him floating in free space, just that it's a more difficult impedance to match. And if he had a artificial grounding circuit with a great big long piece of wire down to Earth, it would work a little bit better. Well, in that particular case, the wire down to Earth would be the other half of the dipole. It wouldn't even have to be attached to Earth, if you know what I mean. So this gives you a little bit more feeling. Let me drop. So, as you can tell, the real requirement for an artificial grounding circuit for a shack that's high above the ground is a little bit spooky, as I see it. If you understand how a balanced antenna works, it requires no grounding. Certain kinds of antennas, like that NFED ZEP, do require some kind of local grounding to give you a reasonable impedance. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, because I was reading, I bought one of these MFJs a long time ago when I lived in the city on the 30th floor, both on the low bands and VHF. I didn't notice much of a difference. I put a radio out of the window on the 30th floor attached to artificial ground. Anyway, so now I'm in a different situation, and I was wondering, I want to put up an inside loop. Now, I used to have a 160-meter full-wave loop one divorce ago, and that's gone. And I was just wondering if I put up a loop inside my, you know, my living room. And from the bedroom, I operated my Kenwood 440. How would RF affect the antenna?
Okay, you're going to have to reword that question, Rich. You've got a loop antenna, and you want to ask, you're asking how will RF affect the antenna? If you're feeding RF into it, it'll transmit. If you're taking RF back out of it, it'll receive. So what do you mean, how does RF affect the antenna? Over to you, Rich.
Kilo Delta Zero, India Kilo Oscar. Explaining impedance matching to someone regarding an antenna.
Okay, India Kilo Oscar, stand by a little bit. Let's first find out what Rich is asking here. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, K2IW. Reword your question, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay. My Kenwood 440 will be in a bedroom. And in the living room, 10 feet away, will be this loop that I put up, fed with ladder line and then into a ballon and then coax. And I was just wondering, because everything is so close to each other, is the signal, the efficiency of the antenna affected?
Okay, you're really asking a question of how much do two antennas cross-couple to each other. That's the real nature of your question. And if the two antennas on an HF frequency are mounted 5 feet apart, no matter what the hell they are, they're heavily coupled to each other, and you're going to get some interaction. If one's in the living room and one's in the bedroom, and they're 15 feet apart, with rare exception, the two antennas do not see each other. In other words, you transmit from the living room antenna and measure the efficiency, the pattern, and the impedance and everything else, and get that as your base material. And then you add the other antenna in the bedroom 15 feet away. Will the living room antenna change in impedance? Yeah. The 50-ohm impedance will go down to 49. Almost no change. The standing wave ratio, you won't see any difference. The signals you listen to, will there be any difference in signal strength? You won't be able to tell the difference. So with any reasonable spacing, antennas do not couple to each other, with another exception. Because there's such a huge difference between transmit power, like 50 watts, and receive power, which is half a microvolt, if you are transmitting out of one antenna while receiving out of the other, even though they're on different bands, one's on 40 meters and one's on 20 meters, because of the huge overload of a local signal, the receiving device is not going to work very well unless you've got a damn good filter in there to get rid of that other signal. So transmitting and receiving simultaneously, you'll think there's a lot of cross-coupling between the antennas. But with any reasonable spacing, they do not see each other. And there's ways you can look up the specifics of that as to how much cross-coupling you're going to get. and in most cases with any reasonable spacing, like 10 or 15 feet, the amount of cross coupling is usually very small, Rich. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LAW.